Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to this session, session 3114, titled, as you see, A Measles Outbreak and the Opportunity to Protect a Nation. My name is Quentin Sandifer. I'm the Executive Director of Public Health Services for Public Health Wales, and we'll mention a little bit more about that organisation in a moment. I'm both the moderator for this session, and I'm also making two of the presentations, and again, I'll explain that in just a moment. If I might just to begin with, on behalf of all the presenters, just declare that we have no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to the subject of this presentation. You will see from the programme that we have a number of presentations. I'm going to make the first presentation briefly, set the context for the presentations that follow, and I've styled mine A Community in Peril. My colleague, Dr. Jörg Hoffmann, who's a public health doctor specialising in communicable disease control based in Swansea, will then talk about the story of the outbreak. He'll be followed by my colleague Dr. Sarah Hayes, who's the Director of Public Health for an organisation known as Abertawe Bro Morgannwg University Health Board, which is based in Swansea, East Port Talbot and Bridgend, which was the area at the centre of the outbreak we'll describe. Dr. Hayes will be followed by Dr. Catherine Moore, Principal Clinical Scientist in the Microbiology Laboratory in Cardiff, herself specialising in molecular virology, and she'll tell you a little bit about the diagnostic tools we developed under the title Time and Space Continuum of Measles Diagnosis. Then Dr. Simon Cottrell, an epidemiologist based in Public Health Wales's Health Protection Division, with expertise in vaccine uptake surveillance, will talk about the methods we developed for monitoring and evaluating the outbreak. This will be followed by a presentation from Susan Belford, a senior communications officer in Public Health Wales, who will talk about the communications handling under the title Levers of Behavioural Change. And then in a late, and I'm sorry to inform you, regrettable last change, Dr. Marion Lyons, my Director of Health Protection, is unable to join us here, and I will give her presentation on lessons learned and next steps. This is a fairly full programme. There is a continuous narrative to what is in effect a story, but I don't want to take you through the whole of that, which would take about an hour, without giving you some sort of a break. So after the second and subsequent presentations, I'll pause to allow a couple of questions, and then hopefully have a little time at the end for wrap-up. All the speakers, including myself, will stay after the presentation, and we're happy to talk to anyone who wants to discuss matters in more detail. We also have our biographical details in the online programme, and you can access it also via the APHA app, and you can reach us by email throughout the programme of this meeting. So let me just very briefly, for those who may not be familiar with the United Kingdom, set the context. Wales is one of four constituent nations within the United Kingdom. Its capital city is Cardiff, 160 miles west of London. Population of Wales is just over 3 million. Since 1999, it has had a devolved administration through the National Assembly of Wales, and its principal areas of devolved power are in health, education, economic development, and transport. The National Assembly has lawmaking powers, and it has used those to good effect already in the area of health, which makes up 40% of the total expenditure of the devolved allocation to Wales. The health system in Wales is part of the United Kingdom's National Health Service, But over the last 10 years, that service itself has evolved in quite distinct and different ways in each of the constituent nations. I would suggest that the principal difference of relevance to this presentation is that the health system in Wales is organised through vertically integrated health organisations known as health boards, and there are 7 in Wales. And these provide a full range of services from primary and community care through secondary to tertiary. There is one public health agency, the agency I work for, Public Health Wales. The centre of the outbreak was located in 2 local authority areas, Swansea and East Port Talbot, located within the geographical boundaries of the Abertawe Broad Morgannwg ABMU Health Board. Swansea itself sits about 45 miles west of Cardiff, and its probable claim to fame that would be better known, at least within tourist industry, is its co-location to the Gower Peninsula, an area of outstanding natural beauty. It's also the host of a Premier League soccer team, the Swans, who regrettably lost this weekend to their arch rivals Cardiff in a local derby fixture. Turning to my presentation briefly, I just want, in a sense, to say a little bit about why this outbreak occurred, and that would therefore lead into the story of the outbreak we subsequently dealt with. So, just hold in your mind that in 1997, uptake of first dose measles, mumps and rubella in 2-year-olds in Swansea was 92%. A year later, in early 1998, Andrew Wakefield published this paper in The Lancet. And following that, there were high-profile claims of harm associated with the MMR vaccine throughout the United Kingdom. Indeed, I think the story of Andrew Wakefield's paper is probably internationally known. Within Wales, there was a particularly virulent campaign, and I don't apologise for the choice of words, by one local newspaper, the South Wales Evening Post, whose principal catchment area is Swansea and Neath Port Talbot. And this was further stoked by a local politician and a very prominent and high-profile anti-vaccinator group. The consequence of all of those challenges was a complete collapse in MMR confidence, not just across the United Kingdom, but particularly in Swansea. So in this graph, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that between 1997 and 2002, national annual uptake of first dose MMR in 2-year-olds fell 11%, from 91 to 80%. That was across the whole of Wales. But in the Abertawe Broad Morgannwg area, and particularly in Swansea, that fell by nearly 20%, from 92 to 73%. Now, through concerted effort over the next 10 years by public health and particularly primary care staff working together, we almost recovered the situation with MMR1 back up to 93%. However, we had a cohort of children who then were approximately 10 to 17 years old who were not fully protected, and indeed 1 in 5 11-year-olds were not fully protected in 2011. So that set the seeds, if you like, for the inevitable events that followed, and my colleague Jorg will tell us about that.
Good morning. My name is Jorg Hoffmann. And I'm a consultant in communicable disease control, and I'm based in Swansea, and I look together with another consultant after an area That's called Mid and West Wales and covers about two-thirds of the landmass of Wales. How it all started, we had no measles notification since an outbreak 3 years prior to this big outbreak that were laboratory confirmed. But in November 2012, we had two notifications initially and then a third one, which had one thing in common. Although they were independent of each other, they were from independent families from quite far apart areas of our patch. They all had stayed over the fall half-term school holiday in a holiday camp in southwest England, in the same holiday camp. And on 26th November, we had a further notification, and we always sent samples out by post to the notified cases, and we got laboratory confirmation on the 27th of November and declared the outbreak officially on the 28th. Despite initial control measures, we had for the next 2 months, December and January, 10 to 20 case notifications per week, and control measures concentrated on individual case management, so the right exclusion advice to be given to individuals notified. And we undertook four school vaccination sessions that were undertaken by Abertawe Broome Organic school nurses mainly in four schools as a response to evidence that there was circulation of measles laboratory confirmed in those schools. This is a visualization of the first half of the outbreak. And you can see these are the three first notified cases, and you can see that they're quite far apart. And I just go quickly through that, and you can see that the concentration then is mainly centered around the Swansea area. On the left-hand side in West Wales, Haverford West, the activity came to a halt, and in North Powys, which you see just at the top of the map, we will hear from Catherine Moore later that was actually a different outbreak. This is the epidemic curve. The light blue are the case notifications, and it's an illustration of what I said earlier. The first 2 months, pretty steady, 10 to 20 notifications per week, and the laboratory confirmed cases are in dark blue. The age distribution, you can see we had the highest number of notifications in the 0 to 5 age group, but actually the highest number of laboratory confirmed cases in the 10 to 18 year olds. So in summary, between 28th November 2012 and 3rd of July 2013, when we declared the outbreak over, we had the biggest measles outbreak in Wales since the introduction of the MMR vaccine. We had over 1,200 cases notified and a high proportion of those laboratory confirmed. 88 cases received some kind of hospital care, and we had one adult preventable death in a 25-year-old young man who died of giant cell pneumonia as a direct complication of measles. The outbreak response summarized cases were risk assessed throughout the outbreak and managed mainly locally, although we had to draw in help obviously from other areas as well. And for the 4 weeks at the height of the outbreak, when we had about 130 notifications per week, we had a measles response centre set up in our capital city in Cardiff with rotating staff, not necessarily communicable disease experts, helping us out with individual case management and exclusion advice to be given. We escalated the control after 2 months and managed not just in a local outbreak control team but in a national senior response team. And that gave also the opportunity to for a national catch-up campaign also involving other health boards that were not center of the outbreak. And one of my colleagues used our data, sent it off to Warwick University in England, and they did some number crunching, and they told us that we probably had, through the maintaining the response throughout the outbreak, giving the right exclusion advice, and all the vaccinations that will be described by my colleague later, we shortened the outbreak by 10 weeks and probably had about a tenth of the case numbers that we would otherwise have had. Thank you very much.
So we'll just pause and maybe just take any immediate questions on the general story of the outbreak, if there's anything from colleagues. Yes, at the back. Attack rates in schools.
The attack rates were not very high. The exclusion that we always advised, because we advised from a start for unvaccinated siblings as well of exposed cases not to attend school, the exclusion wasn't followed very well. That's right. We even making the recommendation, which we did from the start, it goes almost above the status of the policy that we had at the time. So the policy should have been that as soon as unvaccinated siblings become symptomatic, they should be excluded. We advised to keep them away from school and parties and sports settings and so on from 5 to 6 days after the onset. We're currently discussing whether we will be able to, in the future, hopefully, to enforce this more rigorously. Yes.
So I think it's fair to say that that is a contentious issue that's still subject to debate in the United Kingdom at the moment. Now, when the senior response team was established, the national team coordinating the response, we took that to the Welsh Government as one of a number of options. And it has to be said that there was reluctance to allow us to take what were perceived as fairly extreme measures at that stage. Having brought the outbreak to a close, we continue to have that discussion, both at local and national level. We haven't won the argument. Some of us feel more strongly than others about the extent to which we take aggressive action in these conditions, but we haven't resolved that matter. And we may come back to that in the discussion later. Just one last, and then I think we need to take the story further forward.
Just a quick context question. Alison Lettenheim, University of Pennsylvania. So we're probably more familiar with the U.S. context here. Would schools have access to kids' vaccine records at school level? Could you say these 18 kids haven't been vaccinated or
something? Well, we'll come back to that because we're going to describe how we managed to identify the vulnerable cases and the surveillance methods we built around that in a moment. Thank you very much, York. Sarah.
Thank you, Quentin. I'm going to hover a bit around here because I can't see over there. I'm sorry. So how do I?
Left
that
right.
One, left, right, yeah. So can you hear me okay? Is that okay? So I'm Sarah Hayes. I'm Director of Public Health in Abertawe Bomaganig, as you heard. There we are. I was involved from the stage when the notifications came into York's office, but he kept me informed every step of the way, and we offered initial response on a case-by-case as we needed to, particularly going into schools. So we found out that your question about did the schools have access to the child's record, we have a centralised child health system, child health record system, which has all the records of the children's vaccinations. But we found very quickly that when we interrogated that, they weren't up to date. So one of the early measures we took was to ask all our GPs to check their records against our child health record and update them. We reckon a good 20% of data appeared to be missing in this age group. And these are children, the child health record is maintained at every statutory step. So the child health, the checks at birth and in the first year, every immunisation, all those that information should be put on the record. But there's a big gap from the time a child starts the primary school to the time they go to high school. There should be a check at high school, but then there's another gap until the next immunisation. So the records get more and more out of date as they go on. So no, the school didn't have access to the child health record. So we validated our records as far as we could to help us identify susceptible people. We sent letters to schools where cases were circulating, saying measles was circulating, but we also sent letters to all the schools saying measles was circulating in the area. And we ran vaccination sessions, as Jorg said, every time that measles was transmitting. So we went into the schools. Unfortunately, we think about 30% uptake rate of the people that we thought were susceptible in those, but we did lots of staff, which was helpful. We encouraged GPs to keep vaccinating in a catch-up campaign all the children on their books that weren't covered. We sent letters to every family that we identified was susceptible through our child health system, reminding them that measles was circulating and now is the time to get their child covered. And we also asked all our health visitors and all our midwives to have discussions with families where there were children to ask the mums and dads, have your children been vaccinated? And if not, please consider MMR now. Now is the time to do it. And that included for the midwives thinking about the health of the pregnant mums and the newborn babies, trying to use any argument that we could to promote vaccination. This wasn't enough. You saw from Jorg's graph that cases kept coming, and by March it felt as though it was escalating. So we moved into emergency response arrangements. We followed what was then the Health Board's draft pandemic framework. We always got some plan in place to respond to a pandemic, and we thought we'll just activate that. That gives us a really good basis for how to move forward. We established multi-agency command and control systems, had meetings to plan the strategic response, and then right after that, the operational meetings, what does this mean, how do you put this into operation? And through that, we designed what we call an integrated community response, and that was so successful that the things that we did through this response have been shared across Wales and copied across Wales. So what is an integrated community response? It starts off with GP vaccination. GPs are available to all our families. They're based in localities. They're easily accessed. They are easily motivated through newsletters and through the right scientific information. So we asked them to just keep vaccinating. We strengthened that through drop-in sessions in outpatient departments in our four major hospitals. These were open access. We had no age restriction. We've clearly targeted children aged 10 to 18, as you could see from that. That's where we're getting the bulk of our cases. But they were open access. We denied vaccine to no one. So there were some people in their 50s and 60s who wanted the MMR, and we let them have it. And in fact, if you remember that graph, there were some confirmed cases in their 40s and 50s, a small number. The thought of turning someone away was just, we couldn't do that. We also enhanced our occupational health service. You are advised to have MMR when you start in healthcare settings, and you're asked when you take up new posts, have you had MMR or measles, mumps or rubella? So there are records there, but they're not held centrally in our occupational health departments. We couldn't ask them for a list of who was susceptible. We knew that a large number of people would be susceptible because of people's attitudes, to be frank. but we established drop-in occupational health sessions in all our four hospitals, and you can see the results of that in a minute. We also went, we had a program going to every high school in our patch, starting with centre and the big high schools to get the biggest bang quickly, but went to all our high schools, all our colleges, our further education colleges, and we worked with our local universities to prompt students there to be vaccinated. We also worked, we have two local prisons, we provided vaccine to them, and then they just got on with their vaccine program. One of those has a Young Offenders Institute, so there are large numbers needing vaccination there. We have a homelessness service. We worked with them because homeless people are often quite young and quite vulnerable and not registered with GPs. So we targeted them. And we also thought about people in long stay institutions, particularly children and young adults, and people in hospital who are going to be in hospital for a long time. They couldn't get to their GP, so we covered them through vaccination as well. Our first outreach clinic, you may have seen it on Sky News, it was beamed across the world. This is where Australia heard about us. We've talked to the States, we've talked to China, we've talked to lots of countries. Our first day, we had long queues, but very good-natured queues. Luckily, it was warm and sunny. This is the outpatient session in Morriston. It was a nice day. People didn't mind waiting, but it was... At one point, they were waiting 3 or 4 hours, so we distributed sandwiches and cold drinks, particularly to the children. Our experience after that was we managed the queue a bit better after that, but people didn't mind waiting because they recognised the problem. Our school sessions, we brought in people who are used to immunising and people who are used to working with children. Each session was led by school nurses, but they did have extra help. Each nurse had a workstation, had the kit that they needed, and we had the anaphylaxis arrangements to hand and so on. But it's quite a... There are lots of... We developed standard operating procedures for each one of these things so that we could just roll it out. We just ticked the boxes and rolled it out, and we could run it again at very short notice because we've done all that planning. The results of all this was we delivered over 31,000 unscheduled MMR vaccinations. You can see that we gave over 5,000 to our 10 to 18-year-olds, which was a great success. Over half of vaccinations were delivered in primary care, the GPs, over 16,000. Because they're drip, 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 they just keep going, they're high volume, they just do it. Our outpatient drop-in sessions, we covered 8,000 people, over 8,000. Occupational health, we did 3,500 people, and that's from a staff of 16,000. So you can see the level of need that was there, and we still have people who are uncovered at the moment. 1,700 were given in schools, 1,100 in prisons, and 82 for the homeless. And these were figures as of July. They'll be going up and up because we're still encouraging, particularly in primary care, we're still encouraging vaccination. To reflect on what worked well for us was I've been leading the emergency planning arrangements for my health board, and I was becoming very concerned about the lack of and the shortage of immunising staff. We have a change of practice here where more and more immunisations are being given in primary care. We have fewer and fewer vaccinators available to us in the health board. But actually in this outbreak, we drew in all those vaccinators in primary care and we had no trouble covering the clinics. We have increased our robustness to react to a mass vaccination event significantly by drawing on a bank of immunisers. And they did it willingly. A lot of them work part-time and have time to spare, and that was very helpful. Our outpatient departments worked tremendously well as mass vaccination centres. Again, in emergency planning terms, we spent a lot of time trying to decide where we would place antibiotic distribution centres for, you know, oseltamivir, for instance, where we'd place a mass vaccination session. Well, we'd do it in an outpatient session. You've got huge scope. They're clinical areas, people are used to working in them, they've got refreshments on site, you can just open up the cafeteria, very much more robust than trying to go into centres like local authority, leisure centres and so on. These are places people are used to working in and it ran very well. Thinking about occupational health, we used peer vaccinators to encourage and to vaccinate each other, giving 3,500 vaccines to a busy working day, much easier if you just get wards to vaccinate each other and so on. So that was very helpful. And we're using that model for the flu this year, our seasonal flu season. Our child health data, we have learned, is very poor. That's no reflection of the quality of work that goes on. It is just that there are so many linkages between the activity and the recording. A lot of work is done in primary care, and that work isn't always transferred to the child health system in a timely fashion. And when children are not in regular contact with health visitors or the school nurse, then there are large gaps in our changes that happen there aren't getting reflected back on the child health system. We've tried to do some short-term minor tweaks to it. We're encouraging all our GPs to check their data, encouraging all our health visitors to check their data, but it probably needs an overhaul of the system. We can't do that locally, and it's a national system, so we'll be working with the national system to improve that. A relatively small point, but refrigerated vans were tremendously helpful because we could keep the cold chain with our immunisation sessions. We weren't sure what the demand would be, so we'd kind of pump prime them with a certain level of stock, but we could actually move more stock in and between venues very easily by maintaining the cold chain with one refrigerated van. It's very flexible, very helpful. And then Susan is going to talk more about our multifaceted media campaign, but we do feel that you need to use every angle you can to promote awareness of vaccination and the seriousness of the challenge. And we do think that we encourage our campaign is very successful in encouraging the public to come forward. And the last thing I'd say that's not on this slide is that to be successful, you do have to have a range of measures. At the beginning, we're thinking, how do you get through to this population? Is it through GPs? Is it through drop-ins? In fact, it was everything. You have to do everything that you can, provide opportunities in so many different ways, and that way you'll get most of the population that you want. Thank you.
Okay, are there any initial questions for Sarah before we move on? Okay, yes, welcome.
So, you contacted the GPs and you told them to vaccinate their patients.
Yes.
Did they reach out to the patients to bring them into their office to get vaccinated, or did they wait for the patients?
We did talk about that, and we actually helped them. We drafted the letters. We identified the children at risk. We drafted the letters, and we wrote them up as though they're coming from the GP, but we sent them out. And we didn't tell them, we asked them. It's a subtle difference. But we went to the local medical committee and talked to them about the issue right at the outset so that they were on board. And we established a weekly newsletter, and we used the top end of that newsletter to give specific information. So if you found that there was something starting to go wrong, we'd put a warning message at the top of that and just to keep everyone in touch. And it has to be said, one last thing, these people had been written to 10 or 13 times before. They were intractable parents, a lot of them.
Perhaps at the end in the discussion we can talk about the continuing challenge for this group of children. But thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Catherine, hopefully your voice can hold out now.
Okay, thank you. Like I say, I've got a sore throat, so I will try and keep going for the 10 minutes. Now for something completely different, because I'm a virologist and my job was basically to bring measles diagnosis into the 21st century in Wales. And I'll show you some of the challenges that we actually had actually achieving this. The first thing is that if you did a poll of doctors around the US and anywhere where you've got elimination achieved and asked them whether they would recognise measles when it walked through the door, I would say 70% of them would get it wrong. And this is actually borne out with the notifications versus confirmed cases in eliminated countries. Sadly for the UK, we lost our elimination status back in 2008. So although GPs are seeing measles more often, they still get it wrong. As Jörg has referred to, we didn't see measles for 3 years in Wales until the start of this outbreak. And so part of the problem with this outbreak was the fact that the diagnosis wasn't keeping up with what GPs suspected was coming through their door. So this is completely confounded by the fact that the UK is desperately urgent to get hold of elimination status once again, and we are totally in the auspices of the WHO surveillance project. So as soon as a notified case comes in through the door, a sample is sent directly to London for testing. And so this is completely circumnavigating the laboratory service in Wales. Now, as you may or may not be aware, that the WHO states that an IgM is the method of choice for proving that a case is actually a confirmed measles case. IgM does not arise in a case until that patient has already had a rash, which can be 4 days after they've already started being infectious in the community. So by the time you have that first case, they've already started second transmission in the community. So what we wanted to look at was how we could assist in this outbreak management by rapidly diagnosing and confirming a case in the laboratory. As we were aware, as we moved forward, that molecular testing is actually second line in terms of WHO testing. So they would have an IgM, then perhaps, if it was positive, they would have a PCR, and then you could move on to the molecular epidemiology after that to monitor where that virus has come from. But as we know, the UK being endemic, we already had measles transmission occurring in England around the Welsh borders. This, to me, was completely unacceptable as a molecular virologist. I knew that as soon as you acquired measles infection, you could start picking up measles RNA within 2 or 3 days of actual infection happening. So this is the PCR that I developed. I based it on an assay that I found from Luxembourg WHO laboratory. But to me, a 2.5-hour PCR is not a rapid test. So my job was basically to make it that it was an hour test. So as soon as the sample came in, that result could be available same day. We also validated the assay to run on dry swabs. So basically what we were asking the parents to do, rather than take the children to the GP practice, was to actually swab around the inside of the mouth. Saliva has a high level of virus, and so send that by post to the laboratory, and we could turn that result around within 1 day. Generally, what we found, I'll just see if this will work. This is a normal sort of PCR curve here. And what you would find is that there's more virus at this end than there is at this end. And we can actually predict this using something called a crossing threshold value, which is this blue line here. So as soon as the virus amplification happened beyond this, you would know that that sample actually has measles virus in it. Originally, what we wanted to do was actually use this test to actually just identify those cases with the more severe outcomes, those who had contacts that needed rapid intervention, such as normal immunoglobulin or vaccination, or whether siblings were also susceptible and we wanted to actually isolate them from school. But actually what eventually happened was because the IgM turnaround from London was so slow, it became our frontline test for the whole of the outbreak. And so until our last confirmed case, in week 24, we actually tested 904 samples coming through the laboratory with an overall positivity rate of 37%. Now, at the peak of the outbreak, we averaged 53% of samples positive, and from the outbreak area, basically everything that was coming through the laboratory was laboratory confirmed. Basically, we could say at the peak of the outbreak, if you were 11 years old, living in Swansea and turned up to your doctor's surgery with a rash, you had measles, which was unheard of. But of course, what we were doing, we were introducing measles into a vaccinated population. We still had 85% coverage in that age group. And so what we wanted to look at was what was the impact of previous vaccination. So this is my sort of very generalized slide. It looks a bit more like modern art there. But the blue line here, moving along the centre, is our positive control. For each assay that I run, I put in internal control a housekeeper gene called RNase-P, and that run in duplicate. So as long as your sample, whether or not your control sample spitted along this line, then I could draw a line of best fit across that to look at what the CT value and how much virus or viral load was actually in that case. So this red line here represents 239 cases with no MMR. The line along the bottom represents the recorded day post-rash onset, so from day 1 to day 10. You can actually detect RNA a lot longer than when your patient is actually infectious, so up to 2 weeks, 3 weeks even, we can actually find RNA in these cases. So this here, the crossing point that's along the side, up here, so further down you are here, the more virus you have on board, and as you move up here, the less virus. So as you can see at day 1, you've got lots of virus, and then eventually it clears. Now, if you're looking at textbook virology, it says that you are infectious up until day 4 after the rash. So you can tell how sensitive this assay is by the fact that actually at day 4, you were still detecting quite a lot of virus. So what I did was I set our positive control just above this, so a CT30. Which represents about day 6 post-rash onset. So this then, anything below day 30 I knew was acute onset, probably very recently infected. And anything after that, you're probably beginning to see antibody response and the virus actually becoming neutralized. And so I could generally work out whether how soon into the infection the case was. So what I then did was I pulled out those cases where I had documented MMR1 and MMR2 prior to the start of the outbreak. The green line here represents MMR1. And you can see that even at day 1 post-rash onset, you were already 7 days. So this suggests to me that already you had not so much viral load on board, you were probably neutralising your virus, and so it was actually protective, and you were probably less likely to transmit that onwards in the community. And this was even more stark if you looked at MMR2. And if you follow that across, you're at day 9, so you've got very small amounts of virus on board. So actually, if we then look at this, to sort of summarise it, so what I'm saying is that the viral load in acute cases in saliva samples is incredibly high, so you should be able to detect those very soon into your assay. Cases with 1 MMR excreted significantly lower viruses, so it was protective and probably represents a reduced risk of transmission in the community. And then what we found with the 2 MMR cases, they excreted even less, or were actually PCR negative. The problem we had was IgM was coming in with low-level IgMs, so they were still being reported as cases. And this is something we need to address, because we don't want it going out to the public that actually, if you get vaccinated, you still get measles. What we want to say is, yes, you get measles, but your immune response bounces really quickly, and you are not infectious, so well done for getting that vaccine. So what I'm saying is that basically what we're doing, it does prime, it may not be measurable, but it does respond very quickly afterwards. Your immune system really does clear that virus. And so then for the time-space continuum of this measles virus, we did some molecular epidemiology. And it showed us, which was very common in countries where you have constant importation, was that actually what we were looking at was 3 outbreaks and not 1. Measles itself is divided into clades, A to H, and then you have 3 genotypes within that, and then from the genotypes are strains. So although the vaccine is completely good and will cover all of those, it's the way that we can monitor the global movement of viruses and work out where viruses have come from when outbreaks occur. Now, our original cluster was caused by something in the clade D8, and it's called a D8 Taunton virus, and this originated in the southwest of England. This is a global virus. You can find outbreaks everywhere around the world caused by this particular strain if you just genbank the sequence for this virus. But what happened then was, as you can see, we had a quiet spell. We had no notifications for at least a week. And then this happened. We had this major outbreak caused by the D8 Swansea virus. Now, what that is just a single point mutation within D8 Taunton. Now, this virus did go a little bit global. We did cause a cluster of cases in Canada, for example. But actually, since we managed the outbreak, the number of cases of this actually being found has reduced significantly globally. I know what I was saying about the Powys outbreak. I wasn't entirely convinced epidemiologically that that virus was actually the same as the one causing the Swansea outbreak. And indeed, genetic analysis showed us that actually it was a virus that was imported from the continent into this particular part of England, and it spread across into Wales. So what we were looking at was another introduction. And again, we also had another introduction into the southeast part of Wales, into a town called Newport, which gave its own. That was a B3 virus. And so what I'm basically saying from this is that you keep your vaccination rates up, because even when we do achieve elimination, we're still going to see these introductions, as I'm sure you will in the US. And so you have to keep the vaccine up right, because then basically you won't have these outbreaks that we've seen. I'd also like to say that basically we need to review the WHO guidelines and really bring PCR to the forefront of actually how we diagnose these cases, to make sure it's rapid and get the molecular epidemiology up there as well, so that we know where the viruses are actually being transmitted from and where they are going. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Actually, it works out at about £15, which is about, is it $20
per test? $22
per test, yeah. And actually, compared to an IgM test, if you're doing serology, for example, all of the IgM testing is done in-house in London, and they use salivary antibody testing. So I'm not entirely sure what the cost of that would be. But for us, it was actually very cost-effective in terms of actually being able to manage cases as well on the basis of this.
I've got a $38,000 bill sitting on my desk for all the virology that we did during this outbreak.
Okay.
Thank you. Come take a seat. And Simon.
Hey, everybody. I'm going to talk about surveillance that we carried out for uptake of the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine during the outbreak. I work in a team of six, and between us we cover most aspects of routine surveillance for communicable disease in the community in Wales. So in addition to providing daily updates on the numbers of reported cases for the senior response team, they set us an additional three challenges. Firstly, to identify the population at risk. Secondly, to provide surveillance information that would help them evaluate how effective the MMR catch-up campaigns were throughout the entire outbreak. And thirdly, most challengingly, to provide timely, real-time and reliable data to monitor progress in the catch-up campaigns. Now, Sarah mentioned earlier that most of our MMR uptake data in Wales comes from our national child health system. Now, this is it's an individual-level database, and it's an operational database. It lets us assess coverage at a variety of levels, so we can look at school-level coverage, health board-level coverage, national coverage. Its main drawback from a surveillance point of view is that nationally it's only updated once a quarter. So although it would help us with our first two objectives, it wouldn't give us timely data. We've got another good surveillance system in Wales, which automatically collects information directly from general practices, using diagnostic codes and treatment codes, and electronically sends it to us on a daily basis. So this was the basis of our real-time surveillance to monitor progress during the outbreak. But because the catch-up campaigns weren't solely done in general practice, we needed to be able to factor in data from a lot of other sources too during the outbreak. So moving on to the first challenge then, to identify the vulnerable population. This graph shows data from our child health system, and what it shows is the percentage of children by single year age band who had not been vaccinated. And the green bars show you the picture in Wales, the blue bars show you the picture in Swansea. So you can see that the most vulnerable children, or the most vulnerable people, were older children and teenagers aged about 10 to 18. And you can see that the situation was much worse in Swansea than in the rest of Wales. Other health boards showed a similar pattern in coverage to this, but the situation was, the gap was a lot bigger in Swansea than in other areas. In addition to providing epidemiological information for the senior response team, we also had to provide operationally useful data to the health boards. So fairly early on in the outbreak, we provided each health board in Wales with a list of secondary schools in their area, and the percentage of children in each school who were vulnerable to measles who had no documented history of MMR. Now, this box and whisker plot shows, it gives you an idea of the spread of the percentage of these children in each school, and it also shows you the disparity between the health board areas. Just to give you an idea, in some of the worst affected areas, we were talking about 20% of children in a school that had no documented MMR history. So moving on to monitoring progress in real time, I think it's fair to say that this is the element of our surveillance which impressed most people, and we've had some good feedback on it. So this graph shows you data that comes from our general practice surveillance, and what it shows you is the number of first doses of MMR vaccine that have been given to patients in general practice in the preceding 7 days. So we're talking about a rolling 7-day total of MMR dose one vaccinations given. I should point out that we couldn't get this surveillance up and running in time to coincide with the start of the catch-up campaign in general practice. So we actually started providing our data about week 2 to 3. And that's quite important because at that time, anecdotal feedback from general practice was that the uptake was relatively good. But if you look at the start of the graph, that's not the picture that our surveillance data was telling us. It was quite a slow start. And it was useful to be able to feed that back to people. So we went from a slow start, we had a very rapid improvement, and at about the peak of the catch-up campaign, GPs were giving around about 10 to 15 times more doses on a weekly basis than they were for the corresponding period in 2012, if you look at the red bars just at the bottom of the chart. Now, I mentioned earlier that it wasn't just the GP catch-up campaigns that were ongoing. There are also schools-based sessions and drop-in clinics in the community. So we had to factor in data from all of these sources. And this was the most problematic part of our surveillance because not everybody could give us the same level and quality of data. So some of our providers weren't able, for instance, to tell us whether they were immunising somebody with a first dose of MMR or a second dose of MMR. And because of this, it wasn't possible for us to monitor coverage on a real-time basis. But we knew how many children at the start of the outbreak needed one or two doses, and we were able to monitor the numbers of doses that were coming in on a real-time basis. So it was still operationally useful surveillance, although it wasn't perfect from my point of view. The caption here shows you an extract from one of our weekly reports to the senior response team trying to factor in all of this data. Now, of course, it's not just the senior response team that are interested in the progress in the catch-up campaigns. So we put together a public-facing internet page to feedback progress to everybody. And this was very useful for surveillance team because at the time we were having a lot of ad hoc requests for information from press, from our communications team, from members of the public, and putting the data up on the internet page and updating it on a daily basis just stemmed a lot of those requests for us so we could concentrate more on the actual surveillance. So once the outbreak had started to slow and the demand for real-time daily data had subsided a little bit, we were able to go back to our community child health system to evaluate the overall effect of the catch-up campaigns. We saw a noticeable improvement in coverage in the 10 to 18-year-olds across Wales, but particularly in the Abertawe Bromwich Health Board area. And the effect was greatest in the Swansea area of ABM. So this chart shows you the coverage by single-year age band of at least one dose of MMR in Swansea as it was at the start of the outbreak. And by the end of the catch-up campaigns, most of the single-year age bands are in excess of 95% coverage, and where the uptake was lowest before, we achieved a real improvement from 86 to 94%. Now, it wasn't just an improvement in children who should have been vaccinated beforehand but hadn't been vaccinated that we saw. The catch-up campaigns and the media attention had also done a lot to get rid of the residual views on MMR vaccination that some people had. And we saw coverage of the routine first dose in two-year-olds increase in all areas of Wales. So this is the picture at the start of the outbreak. The green areas indicate were uptakes in excess of 95%. By the end of the outbreak, the map's a lot greener across Wales, although not all green. and we saw the same picture for uptake of a complete two-dose course by 5 years of age. So this is the picture before the outbreak. And then by the end of the outbreak, it's a lot better, although clearly still not up there at 95% everywhere. So if I had to summarise this section of the story into three key messages for colleagues conducting this kind of surveillance, the first message would be that unless you're very lucky, there's not going to be one surveillance solution to all of your questions. So you're going to have to be creative and develop things. But the kind of interest and support that you get from senior colleagues during this kind of outbreak can really help you make the improvements that you want to make to the systems, so make the most of it. The second would be that real-time surveillance information does make a real difference. The feedback we had from the senior response team and from the people on the ground doing the immunisations was that knowing what was happening as it was happening made a difference, and people were acting on the information that we provided on a daily basis. And that brings me to my third point. Sometimes working on routine surveillance, there's a danger that you can be quite far removed from what the surveillance data actually means. Surveillance is supposed to be information for action. And during the outbreak, we could see the actions that our surveillance data was prompting on a day-in, day-out basis, which really reinforced the importance of surveillance and what it does, and also the importance of getting it right. That's my the end of my section of the presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions for Simon about the epidemiological surveillance? We can perhaps pick up some of the wider discussion toward the end. But Susan, do you want to tell us how we get communications?
Hi. I plan to describe the communication support for the measles outbreak that both the Public Health Wales communications team and the ABMU communications team provided. So the role of my communications team was to help coordinate the multi-agency response, but also importantly help coordinate the communications department's responses. And this is really to ensure consistent messaging. We had weekly teleconferences with communications teams from both local authorities and health boards, just to really make sure that they understood the key messages. It also meant that everyone knew who was responsible for communicating with who, so messages weren't duplicated, but also everyone was engaged with. We conducted a stakeholder analysis and engaged with quite a wide variety of stakeholders, including professional soccer players and rugby players, charities, schools, scout and guide associations, just to name a few, just to help get the MMR message across. We also ensured that our partners directed people to our website for the latest information, and likewise we directed people to the health board websites for local information. And by working together, we made sure that the roles and everyone understood their roles and responsibilities, and the messages then were consistent. As the measles outbreak went on, we were getting our messages out there. As Simon's alluded to, the school-based clinics' uptake was disappointing. And what we really wanted to do was find out why that was. So we undertook a telephone survey carried out by Public Health Wales staff to try and establish parents' awareness of school-based clinics, their reasons for non-response, and really try and understand the opportunities and barriers parents saw for accessing vaccinations for their children. Of the 119 interviews that we conducted, 88 responded to say that their children had the two doses of MMR, and incidentally 60% of those said it was because of the latest outbreak. But the main of those who confirmed their children were not protected, the main reasons given included their belief that measles wasn't serious, their belief that they'd already made alternative arrangements other than the school-based clinics, they're with their GPs or the outpatient clinics. They thought their children were fully vaccinated or had had measles in the past. The concerns about the safety of the vaccination, or the fact that just they did not want their children vaccinated, full stop. 12 respondents actually requested a callback, so health professionals did have a chat with them, and that was primarily about the safety of the vaccine. But from our point of view, we found it a great exercise to really understand parents' concerns that they could be addressed and really responded to in future communications. the online conversation, it was a real, social media and online media was a key method of engaging with a wide range of stakeholders. Social media provided us with an important two-way method of communications where we were able to listen to the response of parents and the public out there and engage with them. The Public Health Wales communications team used social media to communicate with key stakeholders and get the MMR messages out there, both in English and in Welsh. Local celebrities were identified as those that the target audience of 10 to 18-year-olds may follow on social media and were asked to retweet key messages. Also, we created a video of one of our consultants answering a lot of the frequently asked questions that we'd been receiving, and we distributed that online as well. Now, the campaign did attract some opponents of the MMR from across the world who shared their views quite strongly, and there was a danger at one point that the online media platforms were going to be dominated by them, and I think a few people were concerned. But we found that we actually very rarely stepped in and moderated discussions because the supporters of MMR would come forward and really dispel all the myths, any of the myths being generated. And this peer regulation we found was so much more effective and powerful than us wading in as the authority and shutting down these sorts of conversations. So from a health board point of view, ABM's health board also had a communication strategy to engage with the public via social networking and dedicated web pages and pages on links to school internet sites. This proved really successful. They had over 500,000 Facebook contacts, and they tweeted nearly 500 times and issued 19 dedicated measles or MMR press releases. I suppose the difference from the 1990s, we had supportive media. The outbreak generated a significant amount of media interest, which we really used to help get our messages out there. Just to give you an idea of the levels of interest, in March and April 2012, my communications team dealt with 66 media inquiries. For the same period this year, we dealt with 418. So quite a large jump in interest. Getting into a kind of battle rhythm was key for us to really handle the expectations of the media. So we issued press releases on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it meant that the media was aware of when they would be getting their information, and they planned their coverage accordingly. It also reduced the number of ad hoc queries we received from them. So I thought I'd just talk you through a typical day so that you could understand kind of the level of and reach of our communications. So on the 9th of April, we issued a press release at 12:30 for the 1 o'clock news on measles cases in Swansea passing 600. We issued it to local, national and regional media and posted it on our website and communicated it through Facebook and Twitter. We had we handled media inquiries from 18 different media outlets, and our consultants did interviews with UK-wide media, such as BBC Radio 5 Live, with an average audience of 6.2 million, Channel 5, BBC Radio 4's World at One, with an average audience of 1.4 million, Sky News, with an average audience of 1.175 million, and Newsnight. Importantly for us, our consultants also did Wales-specific broadcast media, and coverage was also achieved in key print media such as the South Wales Evening Post and the Western Mail, which covers Cardiff area. Now, there are a number of factors that enabled the communications team to really respond to this unprecedented level and keep remaining in control of the story. So firstly, our consultants and registrars were brilliant, and they recognised the importance of conducting media interviews. They made themselves available day and night to complete interviews, and they were either outside our offices or they travelled to the media studios. We produced updates for spokespeople to ensure consistency of message. The story was developing on a daily basis, and we wanted to make sure that clear, concise and consistent messages were communicated during interviews. The ability, we as a communications team, we're quite small not really equipped to deal with the level of interest we had. So we were able to draw on support from staff from outside the communications team, but within the Public Health Wales organisation. And they helped us monitor social media, answer the phones, just give some people a break for a bit. And finally, the communications team, actually, we had quite good relations with the Welsh media. And they really understood their role from the early onset in communicating the messages and reporting the outbreak in a responsible way. As Sarah said earlier, the outbreak generated interest on a local, regional, national and international stage, and we had media inquiries from as far afield as Russia and the US. An Australian film crew also came and filmed in Swansea because in Australia at the time there was a real debate going on about MMR, so they wanted to kind of show this side of what happens. And we were pleased to see that the outbreak and subsequent coverage led to catch-up campaigns being rolled out across Wales, but also in England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. So that's me.
I don't know if you've got any questions about the... Come on, Jordan. Any questions for Susan? Okay, well, all right, so I'm going to make the closing presentation, which, as I say, I had hoped my Director of Health Protection would be able to join us. As the Executive Director of Public Health Services, I had overall responsibility across the whole of Wales for the coordination and management of the outbreak and chaired our senior response team. And I just wanted to say up front here, I think it was a really good effort by everyone. You know, we started off with something that we weren't quite sure was going to take off. In hindsight, we had no idea at the time that we had a small outbreak that had almost burnt itself out. And then just at the right time, we recognised early enough the need to scale up quickly. And indeed, I have to add here the support of the Welsh Government to enable us then to mobilise right across Wales and across the United Kingdom was really helpful. So what did we learn and what are we going to do next? Well, it's self-obvious, isn't it, that we always knew that this was an outbreak that was just waiting to happen. This wasn't because of a lack of effort on the part of public health and primary care and other health staff across Wales. We just had a cohort who had just missed out and who were declining the opportunity despite repeated attempts. And I think this remains our biggest challenge going forward, as I'll come back to in a moment. What you've heard is a whole of Wales, whole of health service, multi-agency response with other partners as well, particularly the local authorities. And I think we showed that that was effective in controlling the outbreak. You've heard about particular features of our outbreak response, which I think were especially important. The strength of timely diagnosis. Catherine's almost single-handed campaign to develop a PCR diagnostic tool that we could apply now in the emergency situation we found ourselves to great effect, and using that subsequently to show through molecular epidemiology the true pattern of this outbreak in genetic terms. But also the surveillance tools, those that we already had to hand and those that Simon and his team had to build in order to respond to the demands that we made from the senior response team and from the local public health service. And you've just heard now the importance of the media in raising awareness. The Evening Post, which had been our enemy 15 years ago, did become a significant and important ally toward the end. But as Simon said, we started off with over 50,000 susceptible young people, We still have 30,000 susceptible young people across Wales. And for those who may or may not have heard about this, within the last 3 weeks, we've had a small reoccurrence of measles with, as of Friday, when we all travelled over, 7 laboratory-confirmed cases associated with one small part of the Abertawe-Bromoganag area. And we're dealing with that at the moment. But we are going to see more, I think, outbreaks. And we still have this challenge that we need to address. So picking up a couple of the points. The first one is for, we're doing a lot of soul searching at the moment. We're having some quite frank and at times difficult discussions with politicians and with the Welsh Government about the need to revisit the response policy within the NHS in Wales. I favour a very aggressive approach. I'm not winning that argument just at the moment. We certainly know that with teenagers, we've got to do a lot more to target teenagers. And this is one particular learning point that I think that we got out of this, is we have to recognise that a 10-year-old is different from a 14-year-old, is different from an 18-year-old, and each of those, in turn, I'll have a different view from their parents. And we've got to find a method of communicating to all those individual ages as well as their parents. So as far as I'm concerned now, I'm quite happy for an 11-year-old to consent for themselves. And we are prepared to do that in any future outbreaks that occur. We need to re-examine the role of healthcare workers. There's no mandation associated with measles, mumps and rubella in the healthcare setting. The pre-employment check asks them whether they are. I mean, their information may or may not be reliable, but if they're not protected, we can't compel them to do so, though we will, and we do strongly advise them. And this is a serious issue, as far as I'm concerned, because I think healthcare professionals in particular need to recognise that they don't just have a responsibility for their own health. You know, I take a view maybe that I don't want it because I'm opposed to flu vaccine, for example, our current challenge at the moment, but also they need to understand that they present a risk potentially to others. And flu vaccination, our current campaign at the moment, illustrates some of the challenges reaching across to healthcare workers under these circumstances. And we're working hard with directors of workforce and HR to really try and persuade them that we now need to revisit the whole of the staffing immunisation policy in Wales. As has been said by Susan, we need to better understand the issue of teenagers not being immunised, better understand what their belief systems are and how we can communicate more effectively. And we need also, I think, to agree future strategies and protocols for dealing with measles cases in Wales. We developed a response which had good effect, but we're still working with procedures, policies and procedures that predated this outbreak that we found weren't adequate to the job. And we need now to go back and work our way through all of those and update them accordingly. There are an awful lot of people that we need to acknowledge. Those who are interested might want to know that we are publishing our outbreak reports as we're required to do. We have to publish formally the outbreak report. We're doing so next Tuesday the 12th. We're having a press conference and a number of people are doing that. And we are getting international as well as national and local media attention for that. But in terms of acknowledgement, I just want to add one to this that isn't on the list, and it would be remiss of me to do so, coming all the way to Boston here, not to thank the International Health Section, with whom we communicated about this as a late-breaking session, and very generously gave us 90 minutes. I would have been, you know, delighted if they'd just given me a one single presentation slot somewhere on the programme. So thank you indeed to APHA and its international section. So just to wrap up from me, this was an outbreak that was waiting to happen. I think we demonstrably showed an effective outbreak response. That response has to be mass, multifaceted. Mass vaccination can't be done by just one approach. Rapid diagnosis is important. Real-time surveillance is important. Outstanding communication support is important. All of those are important. But having said all of that and got ourselves to where we are, we've barely begun with the challenge that first beset us 15 years ago. We still have the 30,000. Thank you. We've got, by my watch, just under 15 minutes to have some open discussion, or if people are getting hungry, they can peel off and head off for the food concessions, whichever way. So I'm happy to facilitate some general discussion now. Perhaps you could introduce yourselves, as colleagues have already done, so we get a sense of who's speaking. Let's start with the gentleman. Yes, you start first, please.
Hi, I work with Oregon Public Health Division, and I've been using your website a lot because in Oregon we have areas with high infection rate. Like you said, we're an outbreak like very soon. So we use your story and the story of rubella in Japan to increase awareness among vaccine refusers and among the community. We publish a newsletter, it's a governmental newsletter, and authorship, but it was meant to go all the providers. I believe learning the lesson the hard way, so I really enjoyed your website. We had two cases of measles among our vaccine refusers a few years ago, and the cost of containing the outbreak was about $175,000. Hospital, state health department, local health department. So I was wondering, how much did it cost?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I've got the Welsh Government after that answer as well. At the present time, we're estimating that the cost to the Health Board is probably of the order of about £600,000. That's $900,000. The total of the bills sitting on my desk are about £90,000, so that's about $130,000. Where it starts to get difficult is working out all the other costs to the other health boards, who of course weren't quite totting up in the same way as the primary health board and we were, as well as the indirect costs. But I've talked with some of our financial team, and their estimate is that we could probably add another £200,000. So you do the math, so that's what, another... I'm beginning to lose my conversion, maybe $300,000. So add that lot up, I guess we're about $1.4 million. Yes.
We are still evaluating the communications around the measles. I think it's fair to say, like Simon said earlier, use a multitude of different methods. So we don't know whether the fact that a Swansea City footballer tweeted to say, I've just given my daughter the MMR, have you had yours? Prompted more people to go to the school's vaccination clinics, or whether it was the letter from their GP. That's the trouble with communications. It's really difficult to be able to say that factor A, you know, the causation of doing something was directly related to something. But what we tried to do was listen to what the discussions going on social media, you know, searching for people talking, not necessarily to us, but to each other, to really understand what the views were. Every question we got to our general inquiries email address or via telephone was used as a frequently asked question. So if one person's asked it, chances are lots of people are asking it, so we put it out there. And then that was used by local authorities, by the health board and stuff, to share those messages. So in answer to your question, it's difficult to say, but just we use lots of methods, so hopefully one of them hit the right note to one that different person.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Taylor Hunter, Deputy Chief Medical Officer of Trump at the Government of Alberta, Canada. And we're at the start of an outbreak that equally sounds like yours. And we have about 13 cases confirmed so far. We know that many are not reported. And we have an unimmunized population in one part of the province in particular, which we know now has been exposed for a large number of them anyway. And so we're expecting a really large outbreak. And I think your story is probably our near future for us. Thank you for sharing the details of your outbreak and what you've done. I'm very impressed with the way you did your communication, how you reached out, and also how you were successful in changing people's minds. You had probably a group of people that were on immunizers, non-immunizers for a number of reasons, Wakefield and other reasons as well. And we were able to change that when we were looking at those numbers. I was quite impressed. So we might want to follow with you because we're trying to do the same. And sometimes some of those details can make a difference. The lab I was very interested in also, because trying to test people without sending them to a public place is one of the challenges. And so might be in touch there also to learn about what you did and what you learned from that. And there is an article in terms of the cost of those outbreaks, and when they're large scale, about $1 million is the right range. And there's a link to somebody gave me an article recently, so you can look it up, the cost of measles outbreak. It's quite interesting. And so hopefully we'll be able to avert that, this crisis. But one thing you mentioned, we don't act aggressively before, we act aggressively during.
Yeah.
And then eventually it goes away for a while, and I think we need to, it's a crisis before it actually happened, I think.
Yeah.
And so I would really support your continued efforts to motivate our government or whoever else you're talking to act before these things happen, because these are disasters waiting to happen. And unfortunately, we are complacent, and it's only measles and all those reasons, and the rates for us, they continue to decline slowly over the years, and so I think we might be in bad shape, but this gives hope also that your campaign is successful. So thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Quentin, you're
going
to say something, I'm
going to
say something as well.
Oh, right,
so.
Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment. I've learned two things. One is that the parents often have moved on after 10 years. They have learned that the Wakefield paper has been... has lost the scientific reputation that he's been struck off in the UK, and they're often quite happy to have their children vaccinated. But people are very lethargic, and we have seen now with our couple of new cases that we have in the very same area that a lot of people who had MMR1, so were completely unprotected before the outbreak, and were offered through drop-in clinics or school vaccination, or through their GP, MMR1 in the outbreak, and got a written paper saying, come back in a month, go through your GP, get MMR2, that the vast majority of these people have not taken up the second MMR. So the willingness is there to have the vaccine, but it has to be made very, very easy for people to actually get it.
Sarah.
Yes, can I just add, the prevalence of susceptibility is different from one country to another. So in our country, MMR was introduced when in about 1970. People born from 1970 onwards weren't exposed to wild measles. So actually we've got a susceptible young adult population as well, certainly up to age 40, 43 here. But this is one of the reasons why we had a very open approach. But actually what gives that gives us the opportunity to offer the MMR to the parents of children. When the parents think about their own health, they're thinking very differently to the health of their own children. And if they're going to have the MMR, they're jolly well going to have their children having it as well. So it's another bit to put into the argument. And it's certainly an issue for occupational health. Our A&E department was very challenged by not knowing who was susceptible, who was protected. But it's another thing that you need to think about. And in your outbreak, think about your profile of who's susceptible and try and make sure you're covering that age group. It's not just the children anymore.
Yes.
My name is Deanna Mattai. I live in Lucie, Georgia. And we just came through an outbreak like yours, for example, with 8,000 people. And Poland also, by the way, is going through its own. And so the question I have is, we don't have your resources. We can't do PCR. We really can do IgM. We have very minimal infrastructure except cell phones. We do have cell phones. Everybody knows. I have a job for you. You can work with them. We also have a Russian system that has decayed starting in 93, and it hasn't been replaced very well. So that's why we have 8,000 cases. Okay, communication and everything goes down. It's dwindling right now. So my question to you is, you attack the problem with every resource possible. You have media, you have communication by mass of Georgians. We can't do that. So what would you recommend for a country like Georgia, which is 4.5 million as a country? And by the way, the people who got me most were over the age of 30.
Yeah.
Not you.
Yeah.
So let's do that.
So that's a very difficult question. I mean, colleagues may want to add something. I think, however difficult it is, and let's just be clear, we had lots of resources, yes, and we were able to mobilise those, and we got the response we did. But behind that, we are still struggling to get the message across to policymakers. And ultimately, I think the challenge, at least from where I'm working as executive lead in a national public health organisation, is to continue to make the case for immunisation as a public health intervention to the government, to, if you like, the people who ultimately will make the policy decisions that will result in the necessary investments in the wider health system, and specifically in those areas that are of immediate concern, and to leverage the... I don't know, you didn't say whether there were any deaths associated with this.
Actually, that's the good news. It was only two deaths.
Only two deaths, but that's two deaths that were avoidable. We had one preventable death. I mean, people shouldn't be dying of vaccine-preventable diseases in the 21st century. Certainly not in westernised health systems. Right, and so I would say that the recommendation for me is to take that case on the back of the experience of your 8,000 cases to your government. And I'm sure you're already doing it, and I'm not going to be able to tell you how that should be done, but that's where I think the argument has to be won ultimately. Colleagues may want to add.
I'd just like to add from the lab side, I think there is a point where the WHO really has to get a grip on this, because they want global eradication and they have to work with you as a country. This wouldn't happen if it was flu. If you had an emerging flu in Georgia, they'd be on top of it straight away. Okay, this is a re-emerging infection, and so there has to be, we have to stand up and say to the WHO, deal with it now, because this is not good enough. You know, having people, large outbreaks where people are dying unnecessarily from a vaccine-preventable disease, you know, like I say, it just wouldn't happen for flu. you know, and they have to treat it the same. Okay, so I think you need to take it back to the European WHO and say, is this really acceptable in today's day and age? And the answer is no. Okay.
York.
In the absence of PCR, although doctors are often not very good at recognizing measles, I think if public health staff, when they take the notifications, go through a standardized questionnaire and a case definition, the public health staff are actually very good in differentiating between what is likely to be measles and what isn't. And you can do that. You can do that over a cell phone.
We've literally got 1 minute, so both of you had a chance before. Do you want to compete between you? Who yeah, yeah, you stood up first. Go on then.
You alluded to the use of immunoglobulin. How many doses did you give, and what were your criteria for that?
We actually have the virologist in the audience who might be able to give you the criteria for normal immunoglobulin.
And that's the end of the session. That's the timer, by the way. It's not. It's not home ringing.
I estimate that we gave about 30 doses of immunoglobulin in the whole outbreak. There would have been, and we followed national guidance, which is available on the internet in Public Health England. If we had caught a lot of the exposed vulnerable contacts of probable or confirmed cases earlier, we might have issued a lot more. But often by the time we became aware of these significant exposures for vulnerable contact, it was too late to expect any real benefit from HNIG, and therefore we took the decision not to give it.
We are past our time, as my iPhone just told us, so can I thank everyone indeed for your attention, and as I say, we are quite happy to follow the conversation up with you individually outside this. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.